Welcome to the All Souls Forum on KKFI. Tonight's show features Dr. Michelle Foster. She is the Executive Director of the Urban Education Research Center at UMKC. Her topic tonight is the history of urban schools and the challenges facing them. We'll do our usual thing tonight. We're going to have her lecture, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll come back with the question and answer period, as usual. This show is recorded on Sunday, September the 22nd, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And without further ado, let us go right to the introduction of Dr. Foster.
Today, we're going to be dealing with one of the problems that has faced all of us and is a problem all around the country, and that is the question of urban schools and what are some ideas of things that we can do. Today, our speaker is Michelle Foster. She came to Kansas City, I think, about a year ago. She has a very long title at UMKC, and I wrote it down so I could get it right. She is the Sherman Family Endowed Chair in Urban Education Research, and she is the Executive Director of the Urban Education Research Center at UMKC. And many of you have probably had a chance to have some conversations with her at the church because she sometimes comes, but now we'll have a chance to hear from her much more today. And then she's going to be able to stay for a few minutes afterwards for some more discussion. So, Michelle.
Thank you very much. All right, now I have a problem because I need my glasses to see distance, but I don't need them to read, so. If I can read what I have, then I can't see you, but it'll work out. Okay, so today what I want to talk about is the problem of urban schools. That problem, of which you're aware, is certainly present in Kansas City, a school district which has not been accredited, has recently made some small gains, and is seeking to be reaccredited. Now, as much as I would like to forget the past, I think that the past is deeply implicated in what's going on in the Kansas City public schools, in the St. Louis public schools, in New York, and all of those cities. And what I'm going to try and do today is give you a historical framework in which I talk about certain periods of time, all right, of things that were going on in the United States, and how those particular periods have created the conditions we find today. And then I'm going to talk a bit about some ideas I have for changing what's going on in the schools. I have a lot to blame lots of different people, including universities, who are deeply implicated in what's wrong with public schools. I should say that. Now, I don't want you to think that I have the solutions. If I had the solutions, I wouldn't be at UMKC as a professor of urban ed research. I'd be going around the world, around the United States, making tons of money fixing the problem. But I do have some ideas. So I think what we need to talk about a little bit is to understand the context that created the situation we see today, especially in regards to African-American pupils. We have to remember that for 200 years in parts of the United States, blacks not only were unable to attend school, but they were prohibited from learning to read. Right? And so what I decided to do was to go back. And I always heard as a kid growing up that, okay, you couldn't learn to read. But, you know, it was prohibited. But I never really tried to go back and see what was some of the legislation that was written in the colonies that prohibited. I'm going to read you a little bit. Slaves are prohibited to read and write by law. Excerpts from the South Carolina Act of 1740. Whereas having slaves taught to read or write or suffering them to be employed in writing may be attended with great inconvenience, be it enacted that all and every person and persons whatsoever who shall hereafter teach or cause any slave or slaves to be taught to write, or shall employ any slave as a scribe in any manner of writing whatsoever hereafter taught to write, every such person or person shall for every such offense forfeit the sum of £100 current money. That's from the South Carolina Act of 1740. There's one from 1819. And that said that any time people were together or assembling for the purpose of learning to read, or they could be suspected of learning to read, that duly sworn officers could come and they could inflict punishment of up to 20 lashes. That was the state of North Carolina, the state of South Carolina, Virginia, in 1819. In North Carolina in 1830 to 1831, anybody teaching a slave to read or write was subject to up to no less than 20 lashes and not exceeding 39 if you were white. But if you were black or a slave, you would have to get a minimum of 39 lashes on the bare back. So I guess the point I'm trying to make, and we have to remember this, is that for 200 years, many states prohibited not only slaves from learning how to write, but freed people as well. There's one from Georgia. I won't bore you with reading it. Now, despite that, black people learned how to read. And one of the most notable stories that I know you're all familiar with is Frederick Douglass. The autobiography of the life of Frederick Douglass, he learned how to read. And he talks about how his mistress taught him, and then how, by deceit and trickery, he got the young boys in the wharf of Baltimore to teach him how to read. He would challenge them, and that's how he learned to read. And recently, an academic whose name is Hysimovich, that's the best pronunciation I can do, discovered there was a narrative written, found by Henry Louis Gates, called the Bondswoman's Narrative. And recently, a man from Winthrop University discovered the origin and how it was that Hannah Crafts, who wrote the novel, was able to learn to write. She had been employed in a building which young girls came, and they recited school parts, you know, words from memory. And he's figured out that she, by listening to them and secreting books, actually learned how to read and write, and wrote a book that's very much modeled on what she actually had heard. So, I want to stress that because, you know, for 200 years, black people could not read and write. Now, I think it's interesting. My grandfather used to always say, well, they must have thought that black people could learn to read and write, because if they didn't think they could learn to read and write, they wouldn't have to pass a law to keep them from doing it. Right? So the issue wasn't so much that we were incapable of learning to read and write, but as it's very clear in these laws, that it would cause people to be dissatisfied, to not submit to their masters, and because of that, to be unruly and difficult to manage. So literacy was clearly seen by the slave owners as something that could liberate you and cause you to be dissatisfied with your condition. Okay. I want to talk about the next period, which I say is between 1865 and 1878, maybe 1898, partly because in 1898 we had Plessy versus Ferguson, right? That was the official end of Reconstruction, although we all know that Reconstruction ended before that, but that was the official end. And that period was a period of great activity around the organizing and organization of schools for blacks. One of the big achievements of that time was the Freedmen's Bureau. And you have to understand that before the Civil War, there was no Southern state that had universal state-supported public education. Now, the slaves wanted that. The slaves understood the power of literacy. And I have to remind people that the slaves didn't think that because they learned to read, they'd be president of the United States, or they'd get some great job. That's not how they understood. They understood the power of literacy for freedom. But it's important to understand that during that period, there were lots of things happened. We had the missionaries that went to the South, the Freedmen's Bureau. We had lots of schools. And someone has estimated that by the end of 1865, more than 90,000 former slaves were enrolled in public schools. There was someone said that it was unbelievable, old people, young people, going to the schoolhouse to flock to learn how to read. By 1870, there were more than 1,000 schools for freedmen in the South. And that was also the period of time when we had lots and lots of historically black colleges that were developed. You know Hampton. You know Howard. And there are many others. Because people believed that you needed to have African-American leaders who could be ready to lead their people. Now, during that period, a number of colleges that you may know were developed, including Lincoln University, our own Lincoln University in Jeff City, Missouri, which I found out was founded, very interestingly, after the Civil War by $5,000 from the 62nd Colored Infantry that had been in the Civil War, and they were given an additional $1,400 by the 65th Colored Infantry, both groups stationed at Fort McIntosh, Texas, but comprised primarily of Missourians. Interesting. And that school was designed to teach African Americans, would be in the state of Missouri. It would combine, as many did schools did, study and labor. You know, you learned math and then you built a brick wall. because the idea was that you needed intellectual development and also the ability to earn a living. In 1921, the Missouri legislature passed a bill, and it became part of Lincoln University. It became the Board of Curators of the University of Missouri. But it was segregated. In 1954, it was desegregated, and today, Lincoln University is primarily populated by white students. About 65% of the students at Lincoln University are white. So it's a historically black college, but not a predominantly black one. Now, we have to understand that these schools were always working under very difficult conditions. The whites in the South were against schools. They burnt them. They harassed the teachers, both black and white, who staffed them. They didn't want them. Despite that, many, many schools were developed, and many high schools of great note were developed during this period as well. One of them, which you are well aware of, was Lincoln High School here in Kansas City, a school that was founded during this period, became quite a good school, attended by lots of students who went on to do great things. There was a comparable school in Sumner High School in Kansas City, Kansas, that people know about. Same thing. And what's significant about both of those schools were able to survive desegregation and become first-class schools. All right? They survived desegregation. It's important to say that. And they still became first-class. Sumner and Lincoln are always on the list of the 100 best schools in the United States. Two other schools that also had that reputation did not survive desegregation. I'm thinking specifically of Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C., which was at one point considered the best high school for African Americans in the country. And I could name the list of famous people who graduated from there, but I won't bore you with that. And also Sumner High School in St. Louis, which also was, like the Sumner High School in Kansas City, a very, very good school. Both of those schools did not survive desegregation. Unlike the Lincoln in Kansas City and the Sumner in Kansas City, which went on to become really great schools, these two schools did not survive. And they ended up becoming just your regular, average, underperforming schools in urban areas. So how can we explain that? Well, first of all, despite all of this discussion about how bad segregated schools were, and I'm not trying to say they were wonderful, in spite of that, African Americans, in part because of the constraints on them, were able to create productive situations for black kids. Now, remember, when we had desegregation, we all had to get on board. I didn't. I was too young. But the whole black community had to get on board to fight for desegregation, because that was the goal. And if you were a black person who criticized it or who possibly raised the fact that it may not be everything you thought it was going to be, you were in big trouble. Now, who's the woman who was from, she's an author, I can't think of her name. She wrote Mules and Men. Zora Neale Hurston was roundly attacked because she raised the point that she had gone to school in Eatonville in Florida, and she didn't see anything wrong with these black schools. And she was roundly condemned by, you know, the NAACP and such people as being not in step with the ideology. And many black teachers who questioned that were also roundly, because what was said was, well, of course, you are self-interested. You're afraid of losing your job. As if that were a terrible thing to be afraid of, but anyway, we're all afraid of losing our jobs. But the point we have to understand is, how did desegregation really unfold? Now, let me just talk back a bit about these schools. You know, a lot of this is historical. At the time we were going through it, we weren't writing about it because it was a terrible thing. We didn't want to be in these black schools. But now historians have started to recreate some of what happened in these schools and have found that oftentimes the teachers and the parents were able to create a good learning environment for kids. We know that the schools were socioeconomically, you know, there were socioeconomic classes in the schools. We know that the parents worked pretty well with the teachers and the students they had. We know that the teachers believed that the children were capable of much more, and that the society was going to change and the children were capable of much more than they could even imagine for themselves. And I did. I'm going to, if you're interested, I'll give you the names of some wonderful books. There's one called The Long Freedom Road by David Chachelsky. He's a white historian who writes about Hyde Park County, North Carolina schools, and tries to understand why when the schools was closed, parents walked from the coast all the way to Raleigh to protest. And what he found out, although he didn't expect to, was that there was a sense in which children were valued in those schools, protected, and there was a close relationship. Another book by Vanessa Siddle Walker, who incidentally will be here speaking on October 25th for the Emancipation Proclamation that UMKC is putting on, wrote a book called Their Highest Potential, which looks at a school in North Carolina, Caswell County, and finds some of the very same things. And my own book called Black Teachers on Teaching, which is a set of 20 narratives of black teachers that trace their experience in segregated schools and many of them as they went to desegregated schools and what they understood was happening when the schools desegregated. Most people also don't know that after desegregation between 1954 and 74, about 20 years, that 30,000 black teachers lost their jobs. Okay, most people don't know that. The NEA has calculated about 30,000 black teachers lost their jobs. Why? Well, if you got two school systems, you got two sets of, you got duplication. And when you have one, you don't need all those people. And so you can easily imagine that what happens is the best black teachers would go and the rest would stay behind. Or principals the same way. They were given assistant principal, told when the phone rings, answer it. But when we think about the decline of black teachers, we have to remember that that took place. And so if you were a black parent, you wouldn't tell your kid to become a teacher, right? You might not have a job. So those are things that most people don't know. Now, one of the things I didn't say, and I want to go back a bit, because after Reconstruction was over, there was also the rise of scientific racism. And you know what scientific racism was. It was that period of time between the 1880s and like 1914, 1920, where pseudoscience decided that they would say, where they would try to explain intelligence and all of those things that explain why some people are superior to others. It's called racial superiority. And one of the things that happened is that's when we had the foundations of the eugenics movement. That's when we had the foundation of IQ tests, right? And it's very much worth reading that stuff to see how those tests came to show that whites were superior. And I think we have to understand the context in which, you know, I say one of the problems that we have in this country is we have the idea of white intellectual superiority and black intellectual inferiority. Those ideas are out there, and they were often reinforced and bolstered by scientific racism, which really tried to show by using psychology, cranial measurements, anthropology, and partly it was developed to allow new imperialism. When Europe was going to conquer Africa, that's what they did in the 1880s, right? They went there and took over. You had to be able to justify what you were doing. And you could do it on moral and religious grounds. You could do it on intellectual grounds. And I want to say that because that's important to understand that, you know, that kind of came of age in the 1800s to the 1920s. And it's surfaced again contemporaneously. You can see it again. So that was going on at the time that we were deciding that we really didn't need to spend that much money, even though we had separate or equal, that black kids were somehow incapable of learning. Okay, so now we have desegregation. We're in desegregation. Black teachers lose their jobs. In many places, unlike in Lincoln and Sumner, which became wonderful schools, in many communities, black schools were shuttered. Children left those schools. They left the history of those schools. They left their trophies, their songs, and they went to the white school. And they were asked to forget that. I lived in North Carolina in the 80s. And one day someone got a call. There was a black woman who was a secretary. She got a call. Come over to the school. There had been a school not too far from the campus, which had been the all-black high school, had been shuttered. And they were going to bulldoze it. And all of the things that were inside, which were trophies and awards, and people ran in to save them. So if we think about it for a moment, what's really saying is whatever you had or you thought it was, it wasn't anything. So again, there have been recent analyses trying to understand what it was that people were able to do in these schools. Okay. At the same time that desegregation was starting, we also had the rise of these same Darwinist perspectives from genetic differences to cultural differences. Now, I've been trained as an anthropologist, so I'm not saying anthropologists are wonderful. They were the handmaidens of what allowed them to go and do the research, you know, to go and colonize Africa. That's what they did. They have much to atone for. But post-World War II educational researchers invented a cultural deficit discourse that blames the victim, and it's still with us today. According to deficit thinking, low-achieving minority youth have parents that don't teach them to be assertive problem solvers or knowledge seekers. They use a restricted code that lacks elaborate grammatical, lexical, and logical functions. And such a deficit language was thought to stunt cognitive development. So consequently, these ethnic youth often lacked a field-independent style. And I would say that if you go to the schools today, all of this thing I'm talking about, which came from universities, is present today. You go to university, you hear it. Now, a lot of the people who are saying these in the schools have no idea where it came from. They don't know. Why would they know? But some of these ideas are so compelling that children are, you know, culturally deficient and they're, you know, they have some moral deficiencies, are so attractive, partly because the reason they are attractive is because that really fits with our view of who African Americans are. In 1994, you may remember the Bell Curve by Murray and Herrnstein, which turns social science back by blaming the failure of ethnic minority students as a sign of ethnic genetic inferiority. And once again, this idea rears its ugly head. Now, despite the critiques, you know, academics now are critiquing this. They created it, and now they're critiquing it. They figure prominently in the discourse of what you hear. Okay, one of the earliest ideas of this was something by a man named Oscar Lewis who studied poor people in Mexico. And it came up to be, that's where this comes from, the culture of poverty hypothesis. And he argued that people who are poor are caught in a culture of poverty. And that's responsible for why they can never get out of it. Now, that idea has lots of currency today. Right? It really does. As a matter of fact, there was an article in the Kansas City Star not too long ago about teachers who are being bullied by parents. You know, we all know that, right? The black parent comes in and you've done something to the kid and they carry on. They used to do it to me when I taught in Boston. You know, they'd come in, they'd be mad, ready to fight. You know, I used to always say, after they screamed and hollered and yelled, I have a way of saying, wow, you're so upset. I can tell you really love your child. Otherwise, you wouldn't be that upset. Oftentimes, it would disarm them. But in some places, they call the police. If you show up and do that, they're calling the police. But this was an article about the rise in bullying by parents of teachers. And the article went on to say that, you know, it's happening everywhere, that not just poor parents do it, but so some upper middle class parents do it too. Right now, if you talk to teachers in different schools, they'll tell you that they're afraid of two kinds of parents. The poor black parent who comes in and raises hell, and the upper middle class white parent who's somebody big deal, they don't like them either. Right? And this article goes on to explain, although we don't really know much about this, we don't know the causes and the consequences and whatnot, we really don't understand it. I mean, I've been bullied by upper middle class white parents in the university when their kids got a C-. Right? Calling to say, to tell me that their child and I had a personality conflict. And that's why they got a C-. I told them, But my point is, you know, anybody can be bullied by parents. But the comment about, even though the article went on to say that we really don't understand what's going on here, one of the comments was that the reason this is going on is because of the culture of poverty. So I'm saying that's a facile explanation that we can use to explain what we see. But as woman who was commenting, Espelage says, she knows that, she said, but, you know, verbal abuse spans the socioeconomic spectrum. There's lots of affluent parents who stop short of violent threats, aggressively question the grades of teachers, that they hand out to their kids and are highly disrespectful. But we didn't have an explanation for that. What's the explanation for these rich parents going in there and raising hell in the schools? They care about their kids? Another example of research that I find, I've been in Kansas City now a year. I will have been here October 1st. And I wonder how these ideas glom on. So I've been walking around talking to people about what's going on in Kansas City. And the one single study that they often cite is a study you may have heard this study, because everybody in Kansas City seems to know it. Maybe it's because it took place at KU. But there's Todd Risley and Hart. They were two, I think, psychologists at KU who were involved in the war on poverty in early childhood education. And so they couldn't figure out why all this stuff they were doing in school wasn't working. They said, the problem must be you have to go check the homes. So they got 42 families, some upper class, some poor, some middle class, some on welfare. And they sent, now listen to the study, observers to go into the homes and visit 1 hour a month and record what they saw and then write down what they saw. And what did they find out? They found out that poor children, welfare children, heard fewer words than middle-class children, right? And they calculated, because they're statisticians, that they heard 3 million less words by the time they went to school. They also wrote that black parents or poor parents, most of the parents that were poor were African-American, used directives instead of, requests, polite requests, like, would you like to go to bed? Okay, and they heard negative comments as opposed to positive comments. Now, they then did a follow-up study and found that, of course, these children didn't do as well in school. Well, no surprise there. But that study has been told to me by at least 10 people since I've been in Kansas City as a reason why these kids can't do well in school. Now, there's a couple of problems wrong with this study, just methodologically. First of all, if you think that you can go, if I can come into your house for an hour a month and watch you with your kids, and then generalize what goes on, I'm coming, because I don't think it's possible. An hour a month? Also, it doesn't allow for the fact that it could be that not just parents are socializers of children's language, but other siblings could be. That's a model that says parents talk to kids, and kids talk to parents, and they don't talk to anybody else. Now, I'm 66 years old, and when I was a kid, parents didn't talk to kids as much. Not as they do today. And they told you to go to bed, and they told you you were being, they said lots of things. But it was never used as a wholesale explanation for why kids couldn't achieve in school. Not in the 50s and 60s it wasn't. Not in the 50s at least. And I also want to say to you that this idea we have of parents, and what's wonderful that parents read to their children. I'm not saying they shouldn't read to them. But this idea of what parents, especially middle class parents, I'm trying to figure out, did middle class parents always do this? Or are they mimicking what the school is doing to get them ready to go to school? And I'm going to give you a little conversation. I want you have to do call and response now, okay? Now is the time for you to participate. I'm going to give you an example of a conversation that you might hear. All right. So here's speaker one. Speaker one says, what time is it? Speaker two says, 3 o'clock. Speaker one says, thank you very much. That's correct. Where did that conversation take place? Let's do it again. What time is it? 3 o'clock. That's correct. Thank you. Where did that conversation take place? Huh? Come on, louder, louder, louder. How do you know? Well, how do you know that took place? How do you know that didn't happen on the street corner? Because that's a school question. Only in school do teachers ask questions that have known answers. That's a script. I initiate, you respond, and I evaluate. It's called the IRE sequence. Initiate. So that's why we know that teachers often talk more than kids, because they are always evaluating. But that's not a real conversation. If you go to the street corner and someone asks you, you ask somebody, what time is it? And they say 3 o'clock, and you say, that's correct. What are they going to do? Walk away or something. It's not a real conversation. And much of what we think as normal in school, those are not real conversations. Those are school conversations, right? So the idea that, and I think we forget that. So there's been a lot of research recently that's tried to look very carefully at what kinds of language children really do hear at homes. And there's a very famous study, and I'm going to invite all of you to come to the grand opening of the center on the 29th of October. Shirley Bryce Heath, the noted anthropologist, has done a wonderful study that looks at poor kids, black and white and middle-class kids, in South Carolina, and finds very different kinds of socialization. It's not that the African-American kids, you know, aren't socialized to language. It's just it's a very different kind of socialization. They're taught to be creative and make up stories. And you know that because they come to school and they do it, right? That's what they do. They tell stories and they make up stuff and people think they're lying. You know, they're very dramatic. And that's what the different kind of socialization they're having in school. Another study piece of work that's been very widely spread is called Ruby Payne. And Ruby Payne is a woman who got a PhD from, I don't know, some school in Indiana. And she explains the culture of poverty. And she argues, and she's done work, she's made millions of dollars on a self-published book where she purports to go to businesses and schools and explain to you, how do you deal with poor people? So that's what she's making a living. She's making a lot of money. I'm telling you, there's money to be made if you got the right story. I could be out making tons of money. I could be making millions. None of her research has been vetted by academics. It's just self-published. But she says, she explains that in poverty, there's freedom of verbal expression, that may be true, an appreciation of individual personality, a heightened and intense emotional experience, and a central kinesthetic approach to life not found in the middle class among the educated. And these patterns, she goes on to say. But she sees them negatively. Now, anybody who knows anything about public speaking would say, wow, that's fabulous. I mean, I see lots of African-American kids, college students too, they speak so well, they should be wonderful writers. The fact that they're not is that the people teaching them to write can't appreciate what they can do. But if you can be a wonderful writer, all you have to do is learn how to turn that into text. Really. But if you think that the language is inefficient, if you think Ebonics is poor grammar, if you think those things, then there's nothing the kids bring you that you can build on that's positive. And that's one of the problems of the deficit theory. Now, it's interesting to ask why someone like Ruby Payne, you know, has captured the imagination of all these people. It could be because those academics who have a different story to tell haven't been as forward in promoting it. I'm going to give you one other kind of idea that you've probably heard. I'm trying to see what time it is. Oh, I only got, 1 minute left. I'm going to stop. Okay, that you may have heard, and it also comes from the Academy. John Ogbo, an anthropologist, was trying to understand why it was that certain groups of minorities didn't do well in school. He called them voluntary and involuntary minorities. So the voluntary were the people that came because they wanted to come, and then the involuntary was someone like me or the Native Americans who were conquered, and it was argued that we had a negative reaction to the, and so we didn't want to do well in school. And so there was this term that came called, I'm sure you heard, acting white. And the Time Magazine and New York Times and even the Wall Street Journal got in on that, right? And a lot of historians said there's nothing in the historical record that suggests it meant that you wouldn't want to act white so you didn't do well in school. And if you go to school, they always talk about they're acting white. They don't want to act white. Well, I do well in school, and no one ever accuses me of acting white. No one, right? Because you can act black and really do well in school. Partly because if you don't spend all your time trying to be someone you're not, you have more intellectual energy to learn. It takes a lot of intellectual energy to be in a school and have to be someone that you're not. And let's be honest, all of us judge people on linguistic styles, dress styles, all of those things. And children bring those to school. All right, so I am not going to belabor the point. I'm going to end by giving you some examples of things that we could do in the Kansas City public schools that have a different view of African-American and Latino kids. And then I'm going to talk about some things that you can do. One thing we could talk about is those kinds of programs which build on the cultural, linguistic, and strengths of kids and their political ideas. Bob Moses, who you remember from he was in the Civil Rights Movement, he did Mississippi Freedom Summer, has developed a wonderful program called the Algebra Project. And it's not any different from lots of other constructivist mathematics, which says that kids should understand algebra, but it's got a political component. He argues that learning mathematics in the 21st century is the equivalent of learning to vote in the 20th. It's literacy for freedom. It's freedom for literacy. That's the message that he tries to convey to the parents and the kids. In order to be a citizen in the 21st century, you have to learn algebra. So why is it not different? But it's got a political component, and it resonates with the community. Or Carol Lee, who is an academic at Northwestern, who has figured out how to teach signifying. You know, that's the kids that the kids do. They signify. They play the dozens with each other, you know, in school. They talk about each other's mothers and fathers, and it's a kind of a verbal repartee they play. signifying. And she's figured out how to do that and help the kids use that to do literary interpretation. Right? Because she says the skills you have with doing metaphor and, you know, and new innuendo are really things you need in doing literary interpretation. Or Terry Meyer's work, which uses findings from the studies of African-American children, the linguistic studies that talks about their cultural and linguistic strengths, that builds a program on how to read on top of that. Or even my own work, which is called LTAPL, Learning Through Teaching in an After-School Pedagogical Laboratory, whereby master teachers who were very successful in whatever school district they worked, because there are always great teachers in every school district. There are. And I was in Oakland and L.A. and Trenton, New Jersey, and San Diego, which, you know, have at least, you know, Trenton has at least as, schools are in Trenton are at least as bad as they are in Kansas City. Okay? They're bad. Where master teachers, I brought master teachers in into schools. We had after-school programs, and teachers who were not as good sat in there and watched in vivo. They watched live their children being taught by a master teacher who could do much more with them than that. And then the kids went home, and we talked about what they saw. Those are all things that we could do. Right? Now, can we do them in Kansas City? I don't know. There are lots of things, of course, that, you know, that mitigate against it. One is the fact that UMKC has not had the best relationship with the Kansas City Public Schools as it should have had. And I'm hoping to try and repair that, but of course, you know, that's not necessarily easy. Trust doesn't come easily. They have no reason to trust Michelle Foster. We could do a better job of preparing teachers to go and work successfully in urban schools. We say we're doing a good job, but it's not clear we're doing a good job. Right. And pretty sooner or later, we're going to have to do a good job because the MOPE PTA, which is coming down the pike, if our kids don't do a better job, guess what? They're going to be out of business. So there's some incentive there. We could also look at some work by a woman named Teresa Perry. It's called Young, Gifted, and Black. It's a wonderful book which tries to look at the philosophical approach to educating African-American children that these people in Lincoln and a Sumner and a Dunbar had. What was it that they did in those schools, again, it's historical, to try and get those kids to invest in schools, invest in education, and achieve. Something could be there for there. Now, you know, there are things that you can do. What can you do? One thing you can do is become educated about the situation. I talk to a lot of people who don't understand how many charter schools there are. They don't know that these charter schools are, you know, launched or that they're developed by certain universities, so that, for example, Academy Lafayette is Central Missouri State, and it's not, you know, it's not UMKC. I had this idea. When I first came to Kansas, now this is maybe a silly idea, but some ideas, you know, you can also fight for social justice. It is, we need to understand that if you're poor, it makes it more difficult to learn. Although, let's be honest, most of the people in the world are poor. And in most African and Chinese, they don't say the kids go to school and they're poor. That's why they can't learn. You know what they say? The kids go to school and they work out because they're poor and they don't want to be poor. It's only in kind of industrialized nations that we see poverty as the reason kids don't do well. In Africa, they say those kids are poor. They're going to study hard because they don't want to be picking sweet potatoes. So they work harder. So that's important to understand. But we can fight for better nutrition, decent job wages. All of that makes it easier for parents to be able to do that. And my last idea, since I came to Kansas City, I was trying to count the number of churches. And there were a lot of churches in Kansas City. A lot of churches. And I thought, let's say there were, I counted between 250 and 275 on some list. I don't know if it's true. I'm sure they're different sizes, small. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if 250 to 275 churches all adopted 30 kids. You know, 30 kids. We're going to adopt and sponsor 30 kids. It could be a class, or it could be individuals, to help them navigate the school system. And I don't know how, I'm not into organized, just an idea. Right? But if we did that, we'd be talking about 7,500 kids to 8,150 kids. And there's only 17,000 kids in the Kansas City, Missouri public school system. So that would take care of a big chunk. So those are things I think that churches can do, communities can do, and UMKC can do to help begin to change things in Kansas City, but understand we're operating in a context where, whether we like it or not, we still all have ideas of the fact that somehow black children are incapable of achieving at high levels. Thank you very much. Did I go over time?
We're listening to Dr. Michelle Foster tonight on the All Souls Forum. We've been delving into the history of urban schools and as well as the present-day challenges for schools here in Kansas City. It's time to take a short break. Let's do that. I got some messages for you. We will come back with the question and answer session right here on the All Souls Forum on KKFI. We'll be right back.
Recently widowed Godfrey is under the spell of Sweet Father Divine, while his teen daughters immerse themselves in Hollywood illusions to escape the racial prejudice of 1950s Brooklyn. But things change quickly when free-spirited Aunt Lily shows up, Godfrey remarries a white woman, Ermina discovers boys, and Ernestine is torn between communism and bebop. In Crumbs from the Table of Joy on L.A. Theater Works, Wednesday at 7 p.m.
What happens to the stuff we throw out? When you throw something away, where exactly is away? Follow the Garbage on Sprouts, Thursday at noon. On October 11th to the 13th, longtime labor activists from all over the U.S. and Canada will hold a conference at the University of Missouri, St. Louis to memorialize labor strategist Jerry Tucker, sum up his legacy and vision, and discuss the future of the labor movement. Leaders from the Chicago Teachers Union, Domestic Workers, L.A. Bus Riders Union, and the Fast Food Workers will be presenting. This week's Heartland Labor Forum will play highlights from our award-winning show about Jerry and talk with conference organizers about what's planned. That's Heartland Labor Forum, Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
I'm going to break with my pattern. Would you say a little bit about how you see the emergence of the core curriculum fitting into this whole narrative?
I am a person who doesn't, you know, I'm not a curriculum person. So I think a curriculum is a guide. It shouldn't be a prescription. Does that make sense? I mean, it really shouldn't be. And part of what's happened is we've had a lot of prescribed things. To me, it's a guide. How people or teachers implement that, I think, is the thing. Now, if it's going to be prescribed, you do it a certain way, I think it has problems. But I look at it, and I don't see necessarily anything wrong with it. Now, I think what's going to happen is the implementation of it, the way we're judging whether people are successful with it. Remember, we like to test people. So, you know, I have this fear that we're going to have this, and we're going to test everybody to see whether they meet the standards. And part of the problem with public schools is, you know, the farmers always say that when they have lambs and the lambs are thin and they're skinny, you feed them, you don't weigh them all the time. Because if you keep weighing them, they're not going to weigh anymore if you don't feed them. And part of the problem that goes on in public schools is we do a lot of weighing and not enough feeding. We need to feed the people. We need to feed kids, all right? So I'm not so upset about that. I've seen other curriculum come and go. But I think that if schools were really running the way they should run, that teachers would have more authority and responsibility for deciding how to teach. That's their job. Now, that's changing everywhere. At UMKC, which I'm ready to throw out at people, we're being now forced to do the same things they're doing in public schools. We got to have learning objectives and activities and blah. Well, I don't teach like that. Even if I do the best lesson plan in the world, doesn't mean I'm going to do that. And just because you have a good lesson plan doesn't mean you're a good teacher. Just because you have, that's an administrative function. That makes administrators happy when they can say, so, you know, so I'm not upset about it. It really depends on what they do with it. Does that make sense? Yes.
It seems to me that charter schools have become like an inkblot test. So some individuals are saying this is a response to the fact that public schools have been not adequately educating children. Other people say this is just a way for private companies mm-hmm. to take over education, to get rid of the unions. I wondered if you could go into the history of charter schools a little bit and how well are they doing at educating kids.
Both and, you know, charter, it's very interesting that charter schools have come about at the particular times when the schools are becoming more black and brown, right? And it's also very interesting that lots of these wealthy communities don't have charter schools. You know, when Johnson County and Marin County start having charter schools, I'll know that's the thing to do, but they don't. By and large, that's not where you find them. So there are charter schools here in Kansas City. I've been to 12 of the 10 of the 13 charter schools that UMKC used to charter, now 12 because one was decertified. And I am ambivalent about them because some of what I've seen, and I haven't been there, like, you know, I'm like the Todd and Risley study. I haven't been there that long. So let me, that's the caveat. I have seen teaching that is not remarkable. I know that a lot of this has been able to happen on the backs of young teachers who are employees at will and who can be let go in a moment's notice. I'm not for that. Not the least, it's not fair to the employees, but it's not good for kids to have teachers that come and go. So while there are some charter schools that are doing okay, many of them are not. And we just closed Derek Thomas last year because it wasn't doing okay. And it's clear that maybe about as many charter schools as public schools are doing well. But you also need to understand, I'll say this, I won't say the name of the school because I don't want to, you know, it's going to be on KKFI, I don't want to come and shoot me. That there is a charter school in Kansas City that UMKC funds that starts with 120 kids in kindergarten and 40 of them graduate. So two-thirds of the kids who start out in the first grade don't graduate from 12th grade. And they say, we got a 100% graduation rate. Of course you do, because two-thirds of the kids are not there. Now, they don't kick them out, you know, but what they do is there's four subjects, math, science, social studies, and whatever else the other thing is, I don't know, science. And in that school, if you fail one of those major subjects, if you get a D or below, you have to repeat the whole grade. Now, how many of you would let your kids repeat the whole seventh grade because they failed, say, social studies? I wouldn't. And there's no summer school. So parents take their kids out, which is what you do, right? So, you know, that's and I know that for a fact. So that's an inflated kind of a thing. And it's true that there are lots of people getting rich on charter schools. Now, as an African-American, a parent who had the chance or the choice and the money to send my kid to a private school, and I did because he would have gone to Boston during DSEG, and as much as I love public schools, I wasn't going to let white folks throw rocks at my kid to go to South Boston. I wasn't going to do it. I said, that's not what I fought for. Right? It's hard for me not to be against parents having choice. Does that make sense? So, you know, I don't often have these definitive answers on anything. But that's my view on charter schools. And again, I think that's something worth knowing more about and finding out. In Missouri, as it turns out, the only two school districts that could have charter schools are St. Louis and Kansas City. So that ought to tell you something about the motivations of people that designed it. You know, that's not true in all cities. States, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just a little history. This church is paired with Carver School, which is mostly Hispanic, but we've done programs with them for several years and have readers and all sorts of things. Personally, our kids graduated from Lincoln in the mid-80s, and I have been a teacher in the Kansas City Public Schools. And I was on the desegregation task force, so been there. What do you think now that
No Child Left Behind?
Yeah, that one.
Nickleby? I call it Nickleby. No Child Left Behind, Nickleby.
Anyway, since that is maybe fading, that whole testing wildly, perhaps, do you think that? And I see that Dr. Green is kind of keeping a low profile, which I think is excellent. Mm-hmm. Do you think that perhaps the district might be more amenable to cooperating with the kind of ideas that you think, less testing, more teaching, more?
Well, I hope so. Again, I've only been here a year, and as you probably know, it's not easy to deal business with the district, you know. And I met Dr. Green because I went to hear him at Waldo, and I kept calling him and everything. And at some point this summer, I wanted to get in touch with, in the spring, so May, I called him 20 times, his office, to get back to me, and I didn't get answers. So finally, his secretary, Sharina Clinton, you know, I'm from the East Coast, so I'm a tough character, and I'm going to get what I want. I called Sharina Clinton so many times, I said, Sharina, it's Michelle. I said, Dr. Greer has not called me back. I wanted him to do something. I said, he says yes or no. I said, but you know what? Tomorrow I'm coming down there with my lunch and my computer to camp out, have him call me. And he did. So, I mean, I think, you know, I've been trying to establish a relationship with them. Again, I'm new, and I understand the politics. One of the things about Kansas City, you've got serious politics. And politics always suffuse a public school system. I was in Houston, and there's a program called HERC, Houston Educational Research Consortium, which has given money to the Rice University to work specifically with the HISD, Houston Independent School District, okay, they're supposed to do research to inform policy. But one of the things she said is that even though they've done research to inform policy, and it's clear what they should do, the Houston Independent School District doesn't always do it. Because there's a lot of other things going on. Okay, for example, one of the most recent examples I can think of is several years ago, all the researchers had decided and come to the conclusion that holding kids back isn't necessarily the thing to do. Right? The research was pretty clear about that, you know. But the schools, they're holding the kids back. Because they said, we're tough. We're going to, you know. So, I mean, it's often the case that the research, even though it's very informative, does not inform policy because of other reasons. They're political. People operate in a highly politicized school district. That was true in Boston. It's true in Kansas City. It's true. So I hope to have a decent relationship with them, yes. I hope to be able – I've only been here a year. And so far, nobody – you know, they're not too mad at me, right? I'm sure it can change in a year, but they're not too mad.
You might be familiar with a recent book, The Smartest Kids in the World, which looks at three very high-performing countries across the world, Poland, South Korea, and Finland, which over the last two decades have dramatically improved their national education mm-hmm. performance, and to oversimplify, have basically credited their country's success with their schools of education, mm-hmm. which have become extremely selective as well as mm-hmm. rigorous. Mm-hmm. I won't ask you about the rigor, but I will ask you about the selectivity. What do you think the schools of education, and UMKC in particular, should be doing to achieve that level of performance among their graduates in selectivity?
Okay. Well, certainly, okay, let me talk about what my view is. I see teachers as models of what an intelligent person is like. That's what I see them as doing, in addition to teaching. And for poor children, the two most educated people they are likely to encounter in their lives are their physicians, that they don't see every day, and their teachers. Right? So how do teachers are therefore a daily representative of what an intellectual or an intelligent person is like. Think about it. So if you're mean and judgmental and arrogant, if I was a poor black kid, I don't want to be like that. All right, so you're showing, so we need teachers who are like that, who model what it's like to be excited. I feel like as a teacher, when I taught first grade or when I teach college, I feel I have to seduce the kids I have to seduce them. I'm seducing. I'm a seductress, you know, trying to get them, draw them into my web of stuff. And I'm pretty good at seducing people, so I have come by it naturally, right? Because that's what you're doing. Now, we can complain about TV and it's terrible and all that, but you're competing with it. And so you're trying to help people understand. Does that make sense? So you need someone who is enthusiastic and excited about it, someone who can solve problems. Elementary school teachers, that's your job, you got to solve problems. Johnny won't sit down, he's throwing his pencil, he didn't do his homework, you got to solve problems. And you also got to teach. Now, I think there's a certain grade point average. You know, we have to have teachers who are competent, but we have to have certain dispositions to teaching. Everybody doesn't have the disposition to be a teacher. Everybody doesn't, right? You got to kind of like kids. You've got to be able to see them as developing people. You've got to see them as people who make mistakes. If you see them, you know, and too many often we see little black boys as adults. They're kids in need of guidance and help. That's who they are. And just like little white boys, that's who they are. So, you know, that's what we need. Now, we certainly need to do a better job at the university. I can think of lots of things that we could be doing that we're not. But let me just say one thing. You're right. The schools of education have an important role to play. But we have to remember that all the fact that we want to increase the performance of teachers, we're not willing to pay them. It's also the case that they pay teachers. Or they respect them. We neither pay nor respect teachers. We don't. All right? And either we're going to pay them or respect them or preferably both. So I think we're somewhat limited in the pool of teachers we're going to attract if we don't think about how we can pay them better. We have to really think about that. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay.
I have a question about best practices. Are there different school districts or cities that have tackled the serving problem better than others, and why?
Okay. There are some that have gone through similar things and have come out. I'll give you an example. Boston is a good example of a city that had similar situations to Kansas City. It had a very contentious desegregation case. I was in Boston at the time. That's when my kid didn't go to public school. You know, it was very contentious. And because Boston is kind of like Kansas City, people moved out of the district. And so in a city which was only 25% population African-American, and usually the school population is double the population of the city. So typically if the city population is 25%, the school population is 50%. In Boston, it's 75%. So it's higher than average. But they've really been able to start to turn the corner. But, you know, it's Massachusetts, and you know how Yankees are. They're serious about schools. No, they really are, right? And so they have begun to make some progress. Oakland has, which just came out of oversight by the school board for like 8-9 years, has started to make some progress. Long Beach, California has made tremendous progress. If you want to know a school system that's really turned the corner, Long Beach is one of them. There's a certain number of things that they've had. Some of them have consistent and long-term superintendents. You can't make progress if you have a different superintendent every year. You can't, right? It's too much turnover and turmoil. You can't. So before Kansas City can begin to make progress, they've got to get some stability in the school district. They just have to. And that's part of the problem here. And we also have to figure out that, you know, the other thing I'm concerned about in Kansas City, now remember I live in Waldo. I live on the 7300 block of Washington. And I'm a little bit concerned, which is right around the corner from Hale Cook, so when they get their school, my property values will go up, so when I get ready to sell, I'll make more money. So I'm not unhappy about that. But my point is, I was involved in that, and so while I'm very excited about there being a school in the neighborhood, and I'm very excited about they're going to do one now in Midtown, I'm very concerned about the fact that initially that school had the perception of being an all-white school for the little precious kids in my neighborhood. And I went to every meeting and raised hell. I showed up. Right? Because I think those schools would be a place to really start to think about how can we have integrated schools, because the cultural capital of those parents really could help the entire school. So I think that would be something that if we have a school at Hale Cook and if we have a school in Midtown, that's something we should consider.
Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to Dr. Michelle Foster. Our topic, what's the matter with urban schools? And we heard quite a bit about the challenges and the history and the opportunity facing Kansas City's urban schools. Hope you enjoyed this. It was an informative show. Tune in again next Wednesday at 6 p.m. for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. This week's show was produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. Special thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing this show. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.